Welcome, everybody. This is the third lecture on entrepreneurship and competition in this, the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, the Free Market. It's January 23rd, 2014. And before I get going with this lecture, let me first just apologize. I was at a conference last week, and so there was not going to be office hours. It was just, I was tied up all Friday and that Saturday. There was just no way I could squeeze it in. But I forgot to send you guys an email, so sorry about that. The other thing is, for that same reason, I am behind in posting quiz 2. So don't worry, you're not missing those emails. I just have to get up to speed. So I will get quiz 2 up pretty quickly. There will be office hours this week for week 3. And tomorrow at some point, meaning Friday, I will send out an email telling you exactly when the office hours are going to be. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started with tonight's material, entrepreneurship and competition. So as we're going to see, this is an area where the Austrian school really is distinct in terms of, I mean, there's plenty of areas where they're distinct, but here is one where it's almost hard to imagine what it would be like to just rely on mainstream economics and not to have the insights that the Austrians provide. And so I will talk about this more as we go through the slides and we hit on particular items, but I just want to say that at the outset that entrepreneurship in particular is something that the Austrians are really great at. And it's, you might say, well, wait a minute, Bob, or you might even say Dr. Murphy, depending on how cordial and formal you are, you might say, well, I thought in lecture 2, didn't you say that Mises' emphasis on economic calculation was a really serious Austrian contribution, and that was one of the defining characteristics that set the Austrians apart from other schools? And yes, but they go together, right? That the only reason the entrepreneur is able to do what he or she does in terms of the Austrian perspective is precisely because of the availability of private property and money prices that are made possible by private property. So to be able to engage in economic calculation, that's something that the entrepreneur needs to have at his or her disposal in order to perform the social function, if you will, that we're going to talk about in today's lecture. So it's not that every time I discuss Austrian economics, I keep inventing new things for which they're unique, and this is the most important thing. They're all kind of related. It wouldn't make any sense for Mises to stress the importance and primacy of the entrepreneur, as we're going to go over in a few minutes, without him simultaneously saying how important economic calculation is, that those two things go together. All right, it'd be like, you know, saying what's the really crucial thing that George Lucas brought to cinema was his emphasis on the Force, and then to say, well, no, it really was really about, you know, the Jedi and how important they were in maintaining peace in the galaxy. And it's so, well, the Jedi wouldn't really do too much if they didn't have the Force. All right, so there you go. So entrepreneurship. Now, everybody knows famous entrepreneurs. All right, and I've grabbed some here. So that's Rockefeller. You know, John D. Rockefeller is this guy. This guy is that. A newer one, Elon Musk, you may have heard of him. And this, of course, is the film adaptation of the fictional character Tony Stark. So those are real famous entrepreneurs. Bill Gates would be another one where everybody knows, okay, yeah, these are titans of industry who conceive of a new product, bring it to market, and they're fabulously wealthy. So that's, you know, the quintessential entrepreneur. But more prosaically, it's an entrepreneur is just the person who is sort of making the actual day-to-day decisions as to how the factors of production in a market are going to be used. Okay, so Mises refers to entrepreneurship as the driving force of the market economy, and that that's really what gives the market its vibrancy, and it's how we understand the benefits that flow out of the market economy. So I'm gonna, as we go through this, I'm gonna be hitting this idea from several different angles. But for right now, let me just stress that, let me switch to the text. That the entrepreneur is not just a manager. All right, so there's a problem or an inadequacy in standard economics where, for one thing, they don't even talk about the entrepreneur. And I'm going to be coming back to this theme as we go through this lecture. But it, like I say, we're sort of spoiled if you've been brought up on Austrian material to see their perspective. It's really hard to imagine how other economists can get along so without mentioning the entrepreneur. That it's literally true. Let me give you an example. So I went to New York University and got a PhD in economics. I am pretty sure nobody ever even used the word entrepreneur in a class lecture. Certainly we didn't get any kind of study material or a test question that had to do with entrepreneurship. And let me postpone the discussion of that until a few slides from now where I'm going to focus on the Austrian contribution. But I just want to warm you up to that we're not exaggerating here. It's not like I'm stretching in order to make the Austrians look special. I'm saying it is downright scandalous how you could get a PhD in economics and academic economics without studying entrepreneurship at all. Now, it doesn't mean they don't know what the word stands for. Obviously, they know what entrepreneurs are, but I'm saying in mainstream economics, there is no role for the entrepreneur. There's no place in the model that you would even need an entrepreneur because the types of things the entrepreneur does in the real world are assumed away in standard mainstream mathematical models of the economy. So you can start to understand, well, wait a minute, if the Austrians are right, if Mises is right that the entrepreneur is really the driving force of the market, well, that's kind of a problem, isn't it? If the mainstream models don't even have entrepreneurs in them. So they're totally misconstruing what happens in a market economy. So in the Austrian conception, and this, of course, is the conception that I put in Lessons for the Economist, just not perhaps with his formal vocabulary or, you know, making the language more accessible to younger readers. What it is the entrepreneur does is he or she is the person who actually hires workers and buys resources and conceives of what products and services are going to be offered to the consumers. And this leads into Mises' notion of consumer sovereignty. Okay, so that word right there has political connotations, but that's not really what Mises means by that. What Mises means, and he has some great metaphors throughout his work on this, is that in the market economy, the consumer is ultimately in charge. And what Mises means by that is if you want to understand what is it that determines ultimately how the resources in society are deployed, right? Because you could use resources for all sorts of things. There's all kinds of timber, there's all kinds of crude oil, there's diamonds, there's gold, there's all sorts of labor of various qualities and quantities, there's all sorts of other capital equipment that we inherited from our ancestors. There's various factories in certain locations of varying degrees of wear and tear and so forth. So given what we have to work with right now, what can we produce economically? Well, that's a really complicated question. There's all sorts of things we could do. We could focus on television sets and pizzas and other consumer goods. We could focus on medicine, telescopes, and other things that might provide for us down the road. And so there's a whole list of trade-offs, and it's almost an infinite amount, or it's a big number. Almost infinite doesn't really make sense. It's a huge number of possible combinations of goods and services that could be made. And so what determines it? Well, ultimately, humans have to determine it, right? It's not that nature determines it. So ultimately, human choice drives it, whatever kind of system we have, whether it's a socialist dictator or an oligarchy or a market economy. So in the market economy, how exactly is it that human beings interact with the physical world to determine whether we're going to make a bunch of diapers or whether we're going to make a bunch of diamond rings? How does that get implemented in practice? And so Mises says in a free market economy, it's ultimately the preferences of the consumers that guide things. So it's a specific arrangement, though, because superficially it looks like the entrepreneurs are in charge, right? If you want to say who determines what kind of cars are made, like, you know, I'm looking around and I see a lot of cars of certain size, like certain models that are being made and certain colors. You don't see a lot of purple cars on the road, but you see a lot of sort of, you know, plain, you know, you see a lot of white cars, you see a lot of tan cars, brown ones, but you don't see a lot of purple cars. Why is that? Well, ultimately, humans made that decision somehow. You know, that wasn't because of the charge on an electron, and therefore there's no purple cars. Clearly, human choice was involved with that outcome that we observed, but specifically how? And so superficially, you might say, well, it's the shareholders. Well, no, let's take it more slowly than that. Superficially, you might say it's the workers in the factories, the ones who are spraying on the paint, or maybe now it's more automated, the ones who are programming the robots that do it. But it, clearly, it looks like in terms of pushing the analysis forward, that the first human beings who are in charge of making it, that the cars are mostly white and tan and not purple, it would be the workers at the factory where the cars are produced, right? So you say, oh, so it's their decision. And if those workers decided to just start making purple cars, then that's all we would see. And you say, well, no, that's not true, because they would get fired, right? Those workers are just carrying out the orders that their supervisor gave them. So, yeah, you could see with the naked eye some worker spray painting the car. And as you guys can probably gather, I've never worked in a car factory, so I don't know how it's done anymore, whether it's actually a worker doing it or a machine. But you realize that's superficial. That worker is literally just carrying out the orders of a boss. And so then you could say, oh, so it's the floor manager for that ship. That's the person that ultimately decides for at least that batch of cars that's getting produced what color they're going to be. And you could say, well, yes and no. Yeah, that person does have the authority to do that, but he's really just implementing the orders of some higher up that he reports to, and so on. And so you could follow the chain of command up, and you might end up at the CEO of the company. And a lot of people would stop there and say, oh, well, the CEO, let's just assume it's a man, he's running the company. And so that's the person that ultimately makes the decision. But if you know a little bit more about how firms operate, you would say, well, no, actually, even the CEO is really just an employee. The shareholders who own the company, they hired the CEO, and they ultimately have the power to fire him. If they don't like the performance of the company, he's gone. And so if he does something crazy, like make nothing but purple cars because he really likes purple, or, you know, maybe his five-year-old daughter tells him, Daddy, I really like purple, make purple cars. He says, okay, honey, for 2014, every Ford that rolled off the assembly line is going to be nothing but purple. Well, he's not going to be the CEO for very long, right? So you see that even that person's power is really fleeting, that ultimately he answers to people. Okay, so it's he answers to the shareholders. And so now Mises is just going to push it one step further and say, well, to whom do the shareholders answer? And ultimately he says it's to their customers. That really, why is it that the shareholders would be outraged if the CEO did something so goofy as to do nothing but make purple cars? Is that they that is would be an unprofitable decision. That they would have to, I mean, they could sell them. You wouldn't junk the cars. If it was a brand new car, it was perfect in every respect except it happened to be purple, they would just repaint it, probably is what they would do. But if for some reason they couldn't and it had to be purple, they would still sell it, but they would have to lower the price because most people would say, well, geez, I would have paid you, you know, $15,000 for that make and model if it were white. But if it's purple, that's kind of weird. I really don't want to be driving around a purple car for the next 3 years, but if you knock off $2,000, yeah, I could do that. You see, so the Ford or whatever car company we're talking about would be making a lot less profit because of that odd decision. And it's not really that much more expensive for them to paint their cars a mixture of white and brown and blah, 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 rather than just all purple. Okay. They might actually save a little bit of money. If you really want to push this in this sort of silly example that I'm working with, push it to its logical conclusion, you could even imagine the CEO telling the shareholders, well, no, I'm saving us money. Because if we just configure the plants to do nothing but purple cars, we don't have to have all the different canisters, and you know, we don't have to throw out containers that are, you know, still have a little bit of paint left in them. We can just use every canister down to the last drop because we'll just do them purple. You know, that they're all the same shade, you know, that kind of stuff. So you could even imagine someone making a case that, you know, come on, really, there's, or maybe not purple, but white, let's say, you know, something real simple, or black, or whatever. But if we just, why don't we just always make the same color car, and that will lower costs. And so it'll be more efficient, we'll make more money. And you can see that the naivete of that is that, well, ultimately the reason that's a bad idea is our customers don't want just one color car. Some customers want one color, some customers want a different color. And no matter what single color we pick, let alone if it's purple, we're going to make people unhappy, and they're going to give us less money for that vehicle than they would have given us had we made it a different color. So that's, you know, think it through, that's ultimately the reason. And you might try to push it further. You might say, well, wait a minute, why are we stopping at the car buyer? I mean, because ultimately don't, you know, Joe Smith, who's buying a car, he would rather it be, he's going to buy a Ford Escort, and he would rather it be white than purple. And so other things equal, he would pay a little bit more for a white Ford Escort than for a purple one. And you're telling us, Mises, that that's the ending point of the explanation. Well, no, why can't we push it further? I mean, where does Joe Smith, is that the name I said? I forgot what the guy's name is now in my little story. Let's say it's Joe Smith, who's going to buy the Ford Escort. Where did he get his money from? He probably got it from his boss or from his job. Maybe he's working at a grocery store, and he's, you know, he's the store manager at a grocery store. That's where he, where his income comes from, and now he's going to use some of it to go buy a car. So how do we know? Maybe his boss at the grocery store says to Joe Smith, I really want you to drive a purple or a white car. And you can see that, I mean, you could come up with some crazy scenario where maybe that is true for a particular employee, but in general, you can see that, well, no, it's the logical stopping point is the consumer for this type of analysis. That generally speaking, the people who are driving, no pun intended, the what the colors are of cars in the real world are the people who are driving the cars who own them or buy them. All right, so that's why, just practically speaking, it makes sense to stop it there. All right, and if you're really an overachiever, we could make an argument about even if somebody's boss did care what kind of car it was, it would be that person's consumption preferences. Okay, but I'm just trying to keep this real practical right now. You can see the logic of it. But clearly, you can't stop the explanation at the worker in the factory spraying the car. You can't stop it at his boss. You can't stop it at the CEO even. You can't even stop it at the shareholders. But obviously, what ultimately determines the color of cars that are being produced is the people who are buying them, the consumers. Okay, so that is the principle. That's the intuition behind Mises' notion of consumer sovereignty. So what ends up happening, of course, is that profit helps steer this whole process. That is how the market signals to the entrepreneurs that they're doing a good job, that they are satisfying the consumers. Because ultimately, let me draw a little diagram. Hang on, let me get rid of that word profit. I need to clear up space. So down here you have the consumers on the bottom, and then here are the entrepreneurs. I'm just going to abbreviate. Entrepreneurs are in the middle, and then up here are the factors of production. All right, we're going to come back to this, I think, in a subsequent lecture and really look at this more carefully. But the entrepreneurs are in between the factors of production and the consumers. So the entrepreneurs go into the factor market. They hire workers. They buy certain types of raw materials. They hire out capital goods or they buy them outright. And they produce various goods and services and then try to sell them to consumers. And so it's ultimately the test of profit or loss that says whether they've done a good job. Because if they're earning a profit, just loosely speaking, it means they're buying resources at a lower price, combining them to create a product or a service that they're selling to consumers for a higher price. And so if they're able to do that consistently, well, that means they're doing something useful with those particular resources. Because if they weren't, if they were squandering them, then that means they ought to be used in other lines. And so those other entrepreneurs in those other lines would be able to bid up the price of those resources and try to like steer them away or suck them away from the unprofitable lines. All right. So that's the way Mises thought about it. Like I said, we'll come back to this idea, I think, in a few chapters. But I just want to plant the seed now so you understand the basis for Mises' view. Okay. So Mises likes the entrepreneur because the entrepreneur is crucial in effectively making the market work for the people. That's not the language Mises has used, but I'm trying to get you to see it's almost like a populist notion. It's kind of ironic because your standard Occupy Wall Street kind of person who just had a passing familiarity with the work of Mises and the other Austrian economists would probably brand them as reactionaries. And they're conservative defenders of the oligarchs and established wealth, and they're against the masses. They're against people. They're against the workers. When it's actually the other way around, that the reason Mises is so proud of, I guess, the market economy, and the reason he writes so passionately in defense of the market economy is that he thinks that's the only social institution that actually channels all the material resources of society into satisfying the desires of the masses in their role as consumers. Okay, so what specifically is the Austrian contribution and all this? I touched on it a little bit already, but in particular, and so this guy, Israel Kirzner, he was one of Mises's students at NYU. So Kirzner literally was a student at NYU and studied under Mises, whereas plenty of people would list Mises as an influence or a mentor, but they didn't literally go to NYU and take classes from him, whereas Kirzner did. And he has a funny anecdote. He said, I think this is true, that I'm not screwing up this anecdote, but when Kirzner was talking about, you know, reminiscing as to when he was a student at NYU and, you know, why did you start studying under Mises? You know, were you familiar with his work in German when he came over? And I believe Kirzner said, I'm paraphrasing, that, well, no, I was just there and I was trying to figure out which professor to study from. And I went and there was looking at the course catalog, and this guy Mises had written more books than anybody else, so I picked him. And so apparently that's how he then went on to, of course, an illustrious career in Austrian economics. But I believe he said that the reason he picked Mises initially was not because he knew who the guy was, but just he had such a huge list of published works. So anyway, Kirzner, he's written a lot on what we're talking about tonight, competition and in particular entrepreneurship. But even by his own telling, Kirzner would say all he was really doing was elaborating upon the work that Mises did in Human Action and elsewhere. And that Kirzner was just, like I say, teasing out the implications of what Mises said. So I touched on this before, but let me come back to it now. In the Austrian view, it's entrepreneurs are not simply managers. All right, so let me just make sure you understand what I mean by that. There is a especially in the Marxist view of the world, there's this notion that the workers are the ones who ultimately create everything. That they're the workers are the source of production, and that there's this parasitic class of capitalists that sort of sit atop the pyramid, and they just skim off of the product created by the workers. And so in the Marxist view, then, what is it that the capitalists do? They just sort of go to the office and sit there and look at some charts and then just maybe tweak some things a little bit, and that's how they run the show. And then just the produce flows into them. You know, they take their cut, and it's just clockwork. And Mises and Kirzner, and of course other, you know, Rothbard people in this tradition, they stress that, no, really, you're just taking it for granted. Like the person who's in charge of the factory, who goes to work every day and oversees all the employees and all the cars are being made, let's say it's a car factory, and then that person in charge is has a very nice standard of living, whereas the workers who are actually making the cars don't, you know, they live at a much lower standard of living. So you can understand how a Marxist looking at that scenario would say, that's not fair. It's where are those cars coming from? It's the workers who are producing them, the guys on the line. So why is it that these other people who just sit in the office, how come they enjoy a much higher standard of living? They're not even making anything. And what Mises would stress is, you can't just take it for granted. Why is there even a factory there? Right? That's the problem, and especially this touches on what's called the socialist calculation debate, where Mises and Hayek were arguing with the socialists about capitalism versus socialism, basically. And the socialist theorists just kept saying, well, no, you know, after the revolution, when we replace the capitalist bourgeois framework with the ruling socialist elite, they'll just come up with plans and with easy instructions. They'll get all the people who go to the factories and run them, and they, you know, they had all these clever ideas for how you could make a transition from the current capitalist approach to a socialist framework. And Mises would write critiquing these people, saying they have the shopkeeper mentality or the manager mentality. They're just assuming the basic structure of production, the infrastructure, is what it is, and that that's optimal, that we're supposed to have such and such many acres of farmland in the current location, and we're supposed to have all these factories located exactly where the factories right now are located. And the workers are all in the right respective fields. And that you just got to oversee this thing and just keep letting it tick away, and just we'll take the output maybe and redistribute it a little bit and give more to poor people and so forth. And Mises is saying that that's entirely misconceiving the truly important entrepreneurial decisions that have to be made in life, whatever the system is, but they're made more rationally under in a capitalist market economy framework. Okay, but ultimately somebody has to decide, or some group of people has to decide, where are we going to build new factories? And each day, in principle, we have to decide, should this factory right now even continue in operation? So it's not merely, okay, given that we're making these number of cars today, what color should they be? It's not even just how many cars should we make today. But the more fundamental question is, should we keep having people show up at this factory at all? Or maybe they should stop. Maybe those workers ought to go somewhere else. Maybe we should have other people come here and take this factory apart, empty it out of all its equipment, send the equipment to different factories, and knock this thing down, or turn it into a shopping mall, or turn it into a bunch of low-frills apartment units. See what I'm saying? So those sorts of things happen in a market economy. You could have a business go out of business, and the factory shuts down and fires all the or lays off all the workers and sells off all the equipment. And so like a socialist would look at that and say, oh, that's the waste of a capitalist economy. Under socialism, we would those people employed, and we would continue to produce. But the point is, no, maybe it shouldn't. There's no reason to suppose that even if a factory was economically sensible 10 years ago when it was built, that today it still makes sense to be operating. That occasionally, because conditions change or because people learn new information, maybe you're going to say, oh, geez, you know what? That factory really should stop. The workers who right now report to work every day at that factory should be going somewhere else. So it's those kind of decisions that the entrepreneurs make in a market economy, and they're ultimately guided by expectations of profit. And so the point is, those types of decisions are going to have to be made whatever kind of social framework you have, whether you have socialist setup or a market economy. But the socialist theorists, when they're explaining how their system would work once they abolish the market and private property, they're not adequately grasping with these difficult questions. The socialist typically would say, oh, well, we'll give these instructions to the factory managers, and that just assumes that you know who the factory managers are, and that the current distribution of factories is optimal. But what if that's not true? So the socialists never really explained, how do you know when to build a new factory and where? And how do you know whether you should shut down an existing factory? That kind of meta high-level question, typically the socialist theorists didn't even consider. And also, the mainstream economists don't usually consider that. Right, in their standard models, there's no room for those types of things. They just will. If you guys have ever taken, I know there's different age groups attending this class right now, but if you've ever taken a mainstream principles of economics course, they'll start with the firm and draw cost curves and revenue curves and things like that, or you know, demand curves. Then you'll tease out marginal revenue and marginal cost, that kind of stuff, and figure out the optimal point that maximizes profits, blah, blah, blah. But that just assumes that you've got the factory and you know the optimal way to produce everything and you know what your market is. It doesn't really say anything about, well, where did that factory come from? How do you know it was the right decision to even make that factory? Right. So it's the shopkeeper mentality that Mises was talking about, it's understandable that the socialist theorist would think that way because that's what mainstream mathematical economics pushes you to think. Okay, why don't I move on here and make sure we get to all the material, but there's obviously a lot more I could have said on that topic. Okay, I want to stress something just as you're reading Lessons for the Young Economist so you don't get mixed up. Typically in there, I was explaining things in terms of monetary profit, and I tried to be consistent in using that adjective, monetary, right? And what I want to say now is I wasn't being redundant by doing that. I was doing it to make sure you didn't get confused, because there's different ways that economists use the word profit. And so when you say monetary profit, what you mean is the difference between how much money you took in versus how much money you spent on expenses related to a particular operation. So that's what the monetary profit would be. But a psychic profit is more of a subjective thing. And that's just saying, what is the value of the next, or sorry, the value of what you ended up choosing compared to your next best alternative. Because remember, this is just review, that the opportunity cost is the subjective value placed on the next best alternative. All right, so this is there's uses of the term profit to mean just in this broad subjective sense, so that whenever you engage in a choice, you're hoping to profit, because you choose the thing that you value the most, and then you say, what's the cost of my choice? Well, it's the subjective value you place on the next best thing that you can't have now because you made the choice that you did make. All right, so there's that element as well. So I'm just pointing that out so you don't get confused. And in particular, again, just repeating myself, in the textbook, I wanted to focus on the more mundane issue of monetary profit, and that's why I kept using that word monetary. That's not redundant. There's different types of profit you might consider. Okay, let's work through a specific example here, because at this level, of course, I don't want to make this get too philosophical, so that's why I'm bringing it back to dollars and cents, because if you go out and read in the Austrian literature, you're going to see discussions of this subjective element and that sort of thing. But at this level, I want to just make sure you don't make a silly mistake. Okay, and so here I want to, that's what the function of this particular example is, what we're going to walk through right now. Okay, so the scenario is, suppose and by the way, the function of this, the purpose is I want to get you to see the difference between profit and interest. Okay, so for economists, and not just Austrian economists, just in general, economists make this distinction, and it's the lay person often uses these terms interchangeably, and so I just want you to understand the distinction between them. Okay, so this scenario, suppose a woman invests $100,000 in a business, and so she's like the owner, or she's one of the co-owners. Over the course of the year, she takes in $100,000 in revenue and has $70,000 of monetary expenses. Actually, assume she's the sole owner. I'll make it easy, okay? So she's starting this business from scratch. And so it takes her $100,000 of her own money up front to get it going. So over the course of the year, she takes in $100,000 in revenue. That's the money she gets from selling whatever this thing's product or service is to its customers. And she spends $70,000 on monetary expenses. All right. And for the amount of work she personally does, she could have earned $40,000 in salary working for someone else. The interest rate is 5%. Let me clarify, too, because I can imagine you guys getting confused. What happens is initially, up front, she spends $100,000 like buying equipment and stuff like that. So that's not what I mean in terms of this $70,000 here is over and above that initial $100,000 investment. Okay, so don't get mixed up. So it's like she invests $100,000 up front to buy some machinery and that kind of stuff, maybe to buy a building where the business is located. And now I'm saying every year she has $70,000 in expenses. She has to hire workers. She has to buy raw materials, that kind of stuff. So each year she's got $70,000 in expenses just for that year's operation. That's different from the initial $100,000 she pumped into the operation to get it going. Okay. So now we want to ask, after a given, a typical year with these kind of numbers posted, what was her accounting or monetary profit? And so you'd say, well, she took in $100,000 in revenue and she had $70,000 in monetary expenses that she had to pay to outsiders. So that's a $30,000 accounting profit. And I say accounting because if you, in terms of the accountants, that's what they would list as the net income here from the operation. Right, that would be called the profit. And so if you read the newspapers and they say stuff like ExxonMobil posted a profit last year of such and such, that's what they mean. They mean how much revenue did it take in minus how much money did it pay out to various things. Okay? But what's the implicit interest on the invested capital? Okay, so this $30,000, even though you might call that accounting profit, that's not economic profit. So the implicit interest on the invested capital, well, you'd say, well, gee, you know, she has $100,000 that she had to invest in this business. And so for every year that her $100,000 is invested, there's an opportunity cost of that. And that's why I had to give you this, because you might have wondered, why do I even know what the interest rate is? Because she put up her own money. She's not borrowing it from outsiders. It doesn't matter. The fact that the interest rate's 5% means the $100,000 that she put in the business, she could have lent it to others and earned 5% on it per year. Right? So she could have earned $5,000 this year if she had taken $100,000, not invested it in the business, but instead lent it out. So implicitly, it's like she paid herself $5,000 or the business paid her $5,000 on her invested capital. Now the implicit salary to herself. So we assumed that for the type of effort she put into the business, because she shows up in the morning, let's say, and opens it up and oversees the workers and has to deal with suppliers and that kind of stuff, right? So for the amount of effort she personally put into it, if she did that kind of effort by selling her labor services to some other employer instead of working for herself, she could earn, let's say, $40,000 in salary. So implicitly, the business is paying her $40,000 in salary, because that's the opportunity cost to her from using her labor in the business and not selling it elsewhere. So what's the economic profit or loss? There's actually a loss of $15,000. Because if you think about it, when all is said and done, she has $30,000 in cash to show for this year's operations. But if instead of running this her own business, what if instead she had taken her $100,000 in capital and lent it out? And instead of using her labor hours in her own business, what if she had sold those to others? Well, then she would have had $5,000 in interest from her capital by lending it out at 5%, and her salary income would have been $40,000 from selling her labor services to some other employer. So she would have had $45,000 in cash had she done that. And so $45,000 is $15,000 more than $30,000. So that's the sense in which she actually lost $15,000 this year by running her own business. Okay, so the crucial thing about this example is to see that distinction between the business generated more money than it consumed, right? She ended naively, the business took in $30,000 more than it used up. And so there's a sense in which the monetary profit is $30,000 with the accounting profit. You know, the accountant would tell the person, hey, you generated $30,000 from the business operation. That's the accounting profit. But economically speaking, was that a good decision she made? And you never know in reality, because we don't know what actually would have happened a year ago if she made a different decision. But assuming it's true to say in the alternate timeline of her, rather than investing in the business and working in her own business, if instead she had taken her $100,000, invested it in other people's businesses, and sold her labor services to other people's businesses, then she would have ended up earning $45,000 in income over the course of the year. And so because what she chose to do generated $30,000 in income, but what she could have done instead would have generated $45,000. That's the sense in which she actually lost $15,000. Okay, so before I move on, I mean, there's all sorts of things you could add to this story. You could say, well, no, but what if she really just likes to work for herself, but she doesn't want to be dependent on the whims of others? Or what if she's really nervous about lending her money to other people and she just feels a lot better using that $100,000 capital, you know, financial capital to buy equipment that she keeps a close guard over in her factory or her place of business, and she sleeps there. And so that's, you know, she's really comfortable knowing that $100,000 isn't going to disappear overnight because of vandals or because of robbers. But if she lent $100,000 to somebody else, she wouldn't be nearly as comfortable. You know, what if something happens to it? She doesn't get it back. Okay, so you could come up with all sorts of ways to qualify this and say that actually she made the correct decision, that she likes to be in business for herself and she wants to invest her capital in her own business and not lend it to others. So I'm not trying to prove here actually that she made the wrong decision, but the point is, if you wanted to do that, you could assign amounts by which she values that. If you want to go that's like the way a neoclassical economist would do it. And you can go down that route if you want. But what I'm trying to get you to see here is, clearly, it's not the end of the story to just say if somebody invests a bunch of his own money into a business and puts his heart and soul into it and works like crazy, and at the end of the year, if the business took in more dollars than it paid out to others, it was a profitable enterprise. No, that's not the end of the story. That there's more to being truly economically profitable than just that our gross revenues exceed our monetary expenses. Okay, let's talk about competition. So I walk through the book how it protects consumers. And when I say protect here, I mean, we should be a little bit careful. In a market, all transactions are voluntary, and so no one is exploited in an important sense. Okay, so I just want to warn you about that, because what I mean when I say protects consumers, the competition protects consumers, is simply that if you had one business that was providing us a good, a product to its consumers, and there was a huge, let's call it a markup, right, that the business could obtain the inputs necessary to make this product for $100, and then the business was turning around and selling the product for $150, well, that's a 50% markup. And if there was nothing really special about the process, you might think, well, gee, that's not fair. Why is the business getting away with such a huge markup when they're not really doing that, really contributing that much to it? But to the extent that that's true, in a free market economy, that business won't be able to persist with such a huge markup. Or at least not if interest rates are low. Assuming interest rates aren't 50%, then some other business person, some other entrepreneur will look at that and say, whoa, that person's selling whatever it is, DVDs, spending $100 on the resources, and then turn around and selling the thing for $150, or let's say phones, mobile phones. Okay. Take $100 to produce the thing, and then it's selling for $150, and the interest rate's only 5%. So that's a really great return on the investment. So we should get into that line of work, of that business. And so two things happen when they get into that line. The competing entrepreneur, they start bidding on the factors that go into this product, and so that tends to push up its prices. So if there's some kind of scarce mineral that's used to make the circuit boards or something, well, that thing's going to get pushed up in price now. The second entrepreneur enters the industry and starts buying up those resources. So now maybe instead of it costing $100 in monetary expenses to produce this phone, maybe the price gets bid up to $130. And then on the other end, if they start making competing phones, now the quantity available in the market's higher, and so the consumers aren't going to pay as much per phone because now the supply is higher. And so in the new equilibrium, the price will drop. Maybe instead of $150, it drops down to $140 for a phone. Okay, so you see that markup shrinks. So I'm just making up a simplistic example, obviously, but the point is, if there really is no barrier to entry, then there's no reason a situation should persist where one entrepreneur really is able to buy up a bunch of resources and not contribute anything special to them and turn around and sell them to somebody else for a big markup. That if there really is nothing that entrepreneur is doing that somebody else couldn't do, well, then why isn't somebody else doing that? And then you see the competitive mechanism I talked about that would whittle down that margin. Now, let me just mention, the margin does not get whittled away to zero. So it's not going to be the case that in the long run, the firms are going to spend, let's say, $130 on materials and then sell the phone for exactly $130, make zero. They're not going to do that because the interest rate is positive, right? Then they wouldn't be earning any return for their shareholders. Okay, so again, just repeating myself, in the market economy, even in the long run, there is not a tendency for accounting profit to get wiped away, but there is a tendency for economic profit to get wiped away. Why don't I go ahead and type that out? In the long run, not a tendency for accounting profit to get whittled away by competition, but there is a tendency for economic profit to be pushed to zero. Okay, so let me just read that one last time. In the long run, there's not a tendency for accounting profit to get whittled away by competition, but there is a tendency for economic profit to be pushed to zero. Okay, so just remember that distinction we made in the previous numerical example. What is the difference between an accounting profit versus true economic profit? So that's what competition does in a market economy. Now, if you do end up with a situation where, geez, even in the long run, it looks like firms like Apple are able to earn a return above even just the normal interest expense, and their shareholders seem to get really nice dividends that they couldn't get elsewhere. And how come? And yeah, there are some competitors that come into the industry, but man, it's like, what is it? But the answer is because Apple is genuinely providing something that other people can't reproduce. And you can say that that's irrational if you want, but for whatever reason, the Apple customers like whatever it is that they're getting by buying Apple products, and some other competitor can't give it to them. And that's why Apple is able to enjoy the monetary profits that it does enjoy that seem to be offering returns above just the going rate of interest. Okay, but having said all that, let me just come back to this other point here that I was making. This point right here. I almost shy away from stressing this issue of protecting consumers because I don't want to give you the impression that in the beginning there's something mischievous going on. That when the first entrepreneur gets into an industry before anybody else does, and he sees this huge profit opportunity, and so he's buying resources at 100, combining them to form a product, and then selling it at 150, and then everybody else looks at that and says, whoa, we got to get it. What a great idea. We got to get into that industry too. This guy's making money hand over fist. If you want to, so it's true that eventually those profit returns get whittled away. But it's, and so in a sense, the consumers are better served because now they can get that, you know, after competition works its magic, the consumers can get that product now at a lower price. Or, and the owners of the materials that are being used in that really cool product are now getting compensated more for their contribution. Don't take away from that, that in the early stage, that first entrepreneur was exploiting everybody, that he was charging too much to the consumers and he was underpaying his workers and the other resource owners. No, that first entrepreneur was a great benefactor of everybody because he jumped into the middle and he or she saw this scope for this new product. So if you're going to single out anybody in that whole story as to who is truly the person that contributed the most to everybody's welfare, it's that first entrepreneur. And this kind of ties back to the point I made earlier on, a signal of how effective that first entrepreneur is the huge returns he was earning. Assuming it was a man. All right, so that 50% return before the other entrepreneurs jump into the industry and whittle down the returns, that 50% return is not evidence of mischief or wrongdoing or exploitation. On the contrary, a Misesian would say that 50% return shows what a great insight this pioneer had. Look at this huge, wide open opportunity that everybody else missed. And it took this guy to realize, holy cow, I could buy these resources over here at 100 to make something that the consumers value at 150. Look at that mismatch. Let me get into there. See, so that's the sense in which the profit motive harnesses the entrepreneurs to do the bidding of the consumers. This is what Mises was trying to get across. That you that the profit motive in a market economy is a beautiful thing, that it makes you serve your fellow man. Right? So this is just Adam Smith's famous metaphor of an invisible hand, that it's okay for people to be selfish in the market economy. I mean, it might not be morally okay depending on your value system, but the market gives you the incentive to channel your selfishness into sitting up at night worrying about how am I going to best satisfy my customers. That's what a market economy pushes the really ambitious, greedy people into doing. It sets up a system in which the way the greedy people get rich is not by exploiting other people, not by hurting them, but by figuring out how can I deliver them products they want and can afford without using up too much of society's scarce resources, because that's the way you make a profit. It's not enough. So first of all, you obviously have to deliver products that your customers want. You just produce stuff that nobody wants, then you're obviously not going to make any money. No one's going to give you their money for it. But it's also not enough to make really cool things that people want to pay a lot of money for if the way you make those things uses up a lot of resources. Because then that means your monetary expenses will be higher than your revenue. So you'll still lose it. You'll still suffer losses. No, the only way in a market economy you get rich as an entrepreneur is if you take scarce resources and combine them into making things that the consumers want to spend more money on than you had to spend money on the inputs. And so, and if you just think through the logic of that, that's exactly what you would want the entrepreneurs to do. And that's what Mises' focus was, and a huge portion of his whole scholarly career was just spelling out the conditions under which that happens and the implications of the fact that it does happen in the market economy. Okay, there's also a sense in which competition protects workers. And again, that same caveat that I gave before is so long as the transaction is voluntary, every labor contract helps the worker in question. But competition provides a further force at work here that I'll discuss now. And that's that because of competition, wages tend to equal what's called the marginal productivity of labor. And so in the textbook, I walk through a numerical example, but the idea is pretty simple that, you know, imagine a so-called worst case scenario where the worker seems to be getting exploited. The worker is hired by the firm and the worker delivers $100,000 to the firm's bottom line, right? The firm, the owners enjoy an extra $100,000 in dividends in a given year because of that worker's contribution to the process. But yet the shareholders only pay that worker $50,000 in salary. And so it looks like, you know, the Marxists might say, look at that, they're skimming half of his output off the top. They're only paying him half of what he's actually worth. They're only paying him half of the product of the labor. He's, in a sense, creating $100,000 in output, and he's only getting paid $50,000. And the fat cats are skimming off the rest. Well, in the market economy, so long as there's competitive labor markets, some other entrepreneur can see this situation and can say to that worker, well, hey, I'll give you $60,000 if you come work for me and do the same thing. And so that would be worth it for that second entrepreneur to make that offer, because he still would be earning $40,000 profit off of that worker, right? The worker would come work for him, generate the $100,000 in output, and yet he's only having to pay $60,000 per worker in salary. So he retains the $40,000. But then you can see that, why would it stop there? Somebody else would still have the incentive, and so on and so forth. Okay, so there's a tendency for workers to be paid the marginal product of their labor. Now, with this, the reason we say tendency is, if you think through it, there's lots of limits on that process. So for one thing, the other entrepreneurs have to be aware of it. Right? The only way that story works, if there's a worker who's able to generate $100,000 output, but yet it's only getting paid $50,000, there, nothing's going to alter that if no other entrepreneur is aware of that fact. All right, so there's that issue. But you can see how a typical Marxist, or just more generally anti-capitalist mentality, where people think that workers are systematically underpaid, you can see how, well, wait a minute, if there's a competitive labor market and there's competitive entry into the industry, how can that be? So another way of thinking about it is, you'll see claims that of rampant discrimination. Like, people will say stuff like, black workers get paid a lot less than equally qualified white workers. Or you'll see claims that female employees get paid 85 cents on the dollar to the male employee when they're equal in all their respects, and that kind of language and statistics. And so there's ways you can delve into that stuff. And just so you know, like, what will a lot of times what happens is, for example, the claims that, a woman only earns whatever it is, 88 cents to the dollar the man earns. And so where they come up with those figures, especially if it's a really big disparity, the most naive analyses are just taking salaries and wages earned by men and salaries and wages earned by women and averaging them, and they're just looking at the two. And that's, so if the woman's average figure is only whatever, 88% of the male figure, then that's up, the woman earns 88 cents to the man's dollar. They might adjust it by hours worth. That would make more sense. Okay, but that's naive, because women and men may tend to go into different occupations. So as you introduce more and more control, so if you say, well, wait a minute, let's adjust for educational attainment. So what if we just look at men and women who have a bachelor's degree in a liberal arts field? And now what happens? And then the discrepancy shrinks. And you start adding more and more control. The way you say, well, wait a minute, let's just look at single women and single men. Because, that could be an issue, that if you're looking at, if you're looking at married women compared to a single man, that could partly explain the discrepancy, because typically, the employer can give more tasks to the single man, knowing that he can stay after hours and work longer. Whereas if it's a married woman, she might say, well, no, I have to go home at 5 o'clock because I have a family to take care of. Right. And so whether that's a good thing or a bad thing from the company's point of view, they're saying, well, we're going to pay more to somebody who's able to stay after hours or work weekends. Okay. So when you start just in the regression analyses that generate these big disparities, when you start introducing more and more control like that, the alleged pay gap shrinks and actually can reverse in certain fields. Right. So there's studies showing, if you just look at like PhDs in certain fields, unmarried, and especially if it's never been married, right? Because you could be divorced and be unmarried. But just focus on people who've never been married, and then maybe for the age, control for the age, da da da. There's certain areas where women get paid a lot more than men once you introduce all those other factors. Okay. Another reason, by the way, that men typically get paid more than women, if you just look at the gross averages, is that men tend to work in more hazardous occupations. So other things equal, if you know you got one job that's pretty stressful and another job is pretty stressful, but the first job, there's also a chance that you could die because it's just a real dangerous work environment. Well, that in the long run is going to probably have higher wages than the other job, just because workers, if the two are paying the same, are going to flock to the job that is not as dangerous. And so in order to attract any workers at all, the other site's going to have to offer more money. Okay, so if you buy the logic of that, that dangerous occupations, other things equal, tend to pay more than safe occupations, and you believe me when I say, on average or in general, men tend to work in more hazardous occupations than women do. Like being a cab driver is a very dangerous occupation because you get robbed and shot so much. And most cab drivers are male. All right. So you can see that alone would partly explain the observed disparity. And gee, why is it that an hour of a man's labor on average is compensated more than an hour of a woman's labor? Part of it is because men tend to go into more dangerous occupations. Okay, so anyway, you can see that, but coming back to this more basic point, if you understand the way competition works, you could say, well, you know, I don't really care what the regression analysis says. How could it be that there's a systematic underpayment of women or of, you know, racial minorities or whatever the group is that you're alleging are being systematically underpaid in the market? Because if that were true, all it would take is one entrepreneur to see that and to then start a firm that hired just those groups or, you know, had a preference for those groups. Right? So if it really were true, like let's say there's a factory and somebody says, you know, I'm looking at this and the men in this factory get paid $10 an hour and the women only get paid $9 an hour, even though they're just as productive, that they make the same amount of radio sets per hour as the men do. It's not like it's a real physically demanding thing. You need to be stronger. No, it's just a matter of assembling these parts and women can do that just as fast as men can. It's not like they go to the bathroom more. No, it's the same. You know, these women produce the same number of radio sets per hour as the men, and yet the women are getting paid $9 an hour and the men are getting paid $10 an hour because the owner is a sexist pig. Okay, maybe that's true, but then if so, that means there's an incentive for some other entrepreneur to open a factory in that industry and hire all the women at $9.50. And then that person, by construction, is going to be able to produce the same amount of radio sets per worker as the other firm, but now this guy's costs are going to be $9.50 per worker, and the other guy's going to be paying $10. And now the other guy's just going to have net because all the women are going to, instead of earning $9 at his firm, all the women are going to go to the other factory and earn $9.50. And so now you've got one factory consisting solely of men earning $10 an hour, and another factory consisting solely of women earning $9.50, and they're producing the same stuff. So obviously the other shareholder or the other owner is going to earn more money. And ultimately what it would mean is that the prices of that product would probably come down. And he'd ultimately put the other guy out of business. He wouldn't be able to stay in business paying $10 when the other person's only paying $9.50 for the same labor. Okay, but you see right away those women would get an increase. And if that seems, you know, odd to you, you could say, well, why, no, this, the sexism is rampant. Well, then why wouldn't a woman start the firm? See what I'm saying? So with all this stuff, so long as you have freedom of entry and there's not institutional obstacles put there by political forces, it's hard to get these lasting inequities or exploitation, whatever term you want to use. So be careful. Don't misunderstand me. I am not claiming that in the real world of the United States or any other country right now on planet Earth, that there is no systematic discrimination of the when that word means what normal people mean by it when they complain about it, right? What I'm saying is, if you had a pure market economy, it would be hard to see how such a situation could last if it really were based solely on, you know, irrational prejudice on the part of the employers. Right. So, for example, in the real world, I do think that in the United States, for example, inner city black males are at a serious disadvantage compared to white males from the suburbs, and that you can expect the white males in the suburbs to earn more, and that that's unfair. But the reason, I would say, has to do with things like the drug war and the horrible government schools and things like that. Okay. So those forces tend to affect inner city black kids more than suburban white kids. And there's an element of racism involved too, because of the political conditions leading to that outcome, I think, are partly driven by the fact that the people in office don't care as much for the one group versus the other. So I'm happy to go about all that. But my point is, those inequities and those disparities are ultimately caused because of the departure from a free market economy. And that it's not, in other words, even if you did have a society with a lot of racists in it, that would not be enough to generate systematic disparities in pay that really had nothing to do with merit, so long as you had a pure market economy, right? Because all it would take is one non-racist employer to do it, or even a racist employer who just liked money more than his racial prejudices, right? There could be an employer who says, I would prefer to hire white people, but you know what? I make more money doing it this way, okay? So there's those elements involved. So ultimately, it's competition protects workers. Okay, and then the last thing, and I'll do, we've got some questions here, and I'll turn to your questions. The Austrian contribution on all this, Hayek had some great work on competition. He has a famous lecture called Competition as a Discovery Procedure. So I didn't want to put it in the syllabus because it's difficult reading and it's not super hard. But because this is supposed to be sort of an introductory class, I didn't want to give you the idea that you really ought to read it, but I'm just mentioning it. And for those of you who are overachievers, it's a classic work in Austrian economics. If you Google Hayek, competition as a discovery procedure, you'll find it. And so what Hayek points out in that essay, or it's a lecture he delivered, that one of the ways to see what competition does for us is that we discover the best way of doing things. All right, so business people who are engaged in competition can figure out new products to offer and can figure out better ways to deliver a given product or service to the customer. And that you wouldn't gain that knowledge if you had a monopoly that was guaranteed by the government. And so the problem with a lot of the standard treatment of economic issues is that people just assume there's a known way to produce something. And for example, one time when I was growing up, I read a letter to the editor that said something like this. It said something like, the government, it was during the winter, in other words, it had been a big snowstorm. I'm from upstate New York where it would snow a lot. And so we had all kinds of plowing services, right? Private people would have a big truck and would put a plow on the front of it, and then would have customers that either, you know, paid them regularly so that whatever it snowed, these guys would come and plow your driveway and plow the street. Or, if there was a big storm, they might get one off customers just calling for that particular song. And so anyway, there was a letter to the editor that said something like, you know, instead of having all these private snowplow services run by individual entrepreneurs and businesses, the government should just take the, you know, right now we have the government plowing the main streets, but the government should also take over plowing people's driveways and things like that. And the reason the letter writer said was that because when services are provided by individuals in the marketplace, they have to charge the customer not only their cost, but also a markup for profit. But when the government provides the service, they can just charge it the price it costs. To the taxpayers ultimately, right? So you see the mentality there, that the person thought clearly it's cheaper to have government performing services because they don't need to earn a profit, where to get people in the market to do it, not only do you have to pay what it costs to produce something, but then you got to do a markup on top of that to give a little something to the entrepreneur or the capitalist who's bankrolling the operation. Okay, so there's lots of problems with that analysis. And because of time constraints, we won't go into all of them. But one immediate problem that we can focus on, this is what I was getting at, is it's not a given fact of nature or even a given engineering fact that you can go look up in an engineering textbook about how you deliver snow plowing services to a city. It's not obvious. Well, how many snow plows should we have? Right? Because that's a decision that needs to be made. That you don't want to prepare and have so many trucks ready with plows attached to them that when it snows, each truck goes to an individual driveway, just plows that driveway, and then that's it, and then goes back to base, so that you have one truck per household. That would be crazy. It would be a hugely inefficient use of resources. But on the other hand, you don't want to just have one truck in charge of the whole city, because then it would take weeks or even months, depending on how big the city is, after a snowfall for the truck to finally get to your house. Right? So it's not obvious how to do it. You can see that's an entrepreneurial decision that needs to be made. It's not obvious what the answer is. So it's not just saying, well, what's the cost of providing snowplow services? There's no such thing. But yet that letter writer just assumed it was obvious. And then, you know, you could refine it. Even looking at an individual truck, you know, an individual thing, it's still not clear. There's all kinds of smaller decisions that would need to be made in terms of running a snowplow business, and it's not clear what is the cost of doing it. And so once you see that, now you understand, oh, wait a minute, if you actually turned it over to the government and had them do it, the costs would be a lot higher and the quality of service would be a lot lower. There's systematic reasons to expect that. So you're certainly not going to get the savings that the letter writer thought, because, oh, it's going to be the same service. The customers are going to see the snow removed from their driveway just as quickly under either system, and the taxpayers will get a cheaper price for it than the consumers would have to pay if they did it in the marketplace. No, the exact opposite. The service would be worse and the amount they would be billed implicitly as taxpayers would be higher. Okay, this guy Dom Armentano is big. He's written a lot on antitrust. And so that's his contribution. So if you're curious and want to see the Austrian views on antitrust legislation, you can look at him, his work. In particular, one thing that the Austrian bring to this is to show that in practice, when the government has intervened on behalf of the consumers in order to enhance competition and to break up trusts and things, that no, it's actually anti-competitive. That what ends up happening is there's an individual firm that provides such great products and services to its customers that it captures a huge share of the market. And the competitors don't like that, so the competitors run to the government and then get the government to hobble this firm. Okay, so that's maybe the final thought I'll make with this is the way in a market economy, the way a firm takes over the industry, becomes dominant, is not through using force in literally squeezing out the competition, but rather out-competing them. And the only way to stay on top is to convince the consumer voluntarily to keep giving their money to the so-called dominant firm. And it can't keep out competitors through any means except by consistently providing better products and services to the customers at an attractive price. Okay, let me turn to your guys' questions. Derek asks, in order to obtain an end, you have to use a means. But using means to achieve an end is itself an action. If using a means is an action, doesn't that action require the use of a further means? If so, doesn't an infinite regress result? I guess I've never thought through that, but I don't. I mean, you could probably email. And by the way, Derek is getting that from the discussion in David Gordon's book. I don't think it's an infinite regress. I think it just got to be clear on what. You know, for any given action, you can clearly specify what's the means and what's the end. So it's not really an infinite regress. I suppose if you wanted to go that route, what would end up happening is there'd be an infinite number of actions. But for any given action, you can clearly say what's the means and what's the end. So there's nothing preventing you, if you want, from further breaking things down into subsequent, you know, nested actions within action. You can do that. But there's nothing forcing you to do it either. It's not like logical consistency requires that you keep doing that. You can always just say for a given action, what's the means and what's the end. Okay. Mike Aman says, I missed the difference between an accounting profit versus economic profit. Okay, so accounting profit means monetary revenues minus monetary expenses. So that's just saying how many dollars did I take in this enterprise and how many dollars did we pay out related to that enterprise over a given period of time, and then that's the accounting profit for that period, or what accountants might call net income. Economic profit is more sophisticated and then looks at the opportunity costs involved. Okay, so not just the actual monetary expenses. So I guess that's one way of looking at it. A profit, loosely speaking, means the benefits from something exceeded the costs, and the difference is the profit. But if you want to start putting dollars and cents on it, you can do that in a business enterprise because money is associated with both the sale of the product and the purchase of the inputs. Okay, so since there's dollars in a sense attached to so many of the components of the enterprise, there's a temptation to say the only thing that matters is what we can attach money to. And that's what the accounting profit is. But the point is, well, no, there are some costs that we can't associate an actual outflow of money with. And yet they're genuine costs that you shouldn't ignore. So for example, the one we did in this class, or this lecture, if you're a business owner and you put 60 hours a week into your business, well, when all is said and done, at the end of the year, it's not that you can look at your checking account balance for the business and say, you know, where necessarily did the money come from? Or maybe you do. Maybe you do pay yourself a salary. But even if you didn't, or even if you paid yourself a very meager amount, the point is you would want to adequately capture the fact that, hey, this person, you know, your labor is valuable and you have an opportunity cost. If you're spending 60 hours a week working at your business, that's money you could have been, those are wages or salary you could have been earning elsewhere by selling your 60 hours a week to somebody else. And so you don't want to just ignore that and say, well, it was free or there was no cost because I didn't have to actually pay myself. That's what you're trying to avoid. Or perhaps what's more intuitive, because it's a little bit weird to think of, you know, because you might say, well, how am I eating if I'm not paying myself? Think of it with your invested capital. So clearly, if you have to borrow $100,000 from somebody else and pay 5% interest, and so that the $5,000 a year in money going out the door, clearly that's a cost of operations, and the accountants will pick that up. And so, yeah, we had an interest expense of $5,000 that we're going to subtract from the gross revenue before we say even what the accounting profit is. But what I'm saying is, what if instead of borrowing the $100,000 from Outsider, you took your own $100,000 and used that? Well, you don't have to actually give yourself $5,000 in interest. You could just say, oh, no, it's a 0% loan. I'm not going to charge myself. But the point is, there's still an opportunity cost. You could have lent that $100,000 to somebody else. So one way I've seen the difference is that economic profit takes into consideration the opportunity cost, not just the explicit out-of-pocket dollar expenses or whatever your money is. Okay, why don't we stop there, because you guys have some good questions here, and I don't want to zip through them and not do them justice. So I will answer these questions in the – where will I do that? In the forum somehow. I got to look and see, because I think we restructured. But in some way, I will answer these questions for you guys, and you will – see them, the ones you got posted here, okay? But since we're out of time, let's stop here instead of me trying to squeeze those in. I'm scrolling through and they're good questions. Okay, thanks everybody for tuning in. So keep your eye out. You will see an email from me talking about when quiz 2 is ready and also the office hours for this week 3.